back to The Mentors. You're on with twin brothers Sergey and Vadim Revzin, and this is a show where we tell stories of ordinary people that became extraordinary entrepreneurs despite lack of experience, money, or connections. Today on the show, we're really excited to have Steve Glaveski, who is the CEO and co-founder of Collective Campus, a corporate innovation and startup accelerator based in Melbourne, Australia, with clients all across the world. We're so excited to have Steve on the show today because he has been able to design a life where he not only does what he loves, but he is able to create the impact that he wants to the world and spend his time on things that actually matter. And this episode is an incredible blueprint for how you can do the same. Aside from being the CEO of Collective Campus, he is an author of Employee to Entrepreneur, a book that launches today, January 9th. He previously self-published more books, including an Amazon bestseller. He has co-founded Lemonade Stand, a children's entrepreneurship program. He hosts a podcast called Future Squared. He's a contributing author to Harvard Business Review and has countless other articles that he self-published as well that we mentioned throughout the episode. As you know, Sergey and I don't do a lot of remote recordings, but Steve has been gracious enough to give us some of his time during his busy book tour schedule that we knew we had to talk to him. And there's so much tactical information in this episode that we know you're going to get a lot of value from it. And now, Steve Glaveski.
So Steve, you know, you're actually the perfect type of person that we love to talk to and whose brain we love to pick, because it sounds like you've done so much in your career. You have your foot in a lot of different things. I know you've been published on Harvard Business Review. You've been a self-published author. You have a book that's coming out right now. You've created multiple companies, but at some point, just like all of us and a lot of our audience, you were just a lowly employee, right? And so I guess where I want to start is, when did you sort of get that epiphany where maybe you were working at a job that you didn't really like, but when were you hit with the entrepreneurial bug, and what do you think really motivated you to start acting towards achieving your goals?
I guess I found myself working in a big consulting firm many years ago, where the purpose of my role was effectively to help large listed organizations comply with their SEC regulations, right? So I was in the corporate world for about 10 years, and you know, a byproduct of this work would be I'd make all these recommendations, we'd come back the next year, the recommendations haven't been implemented, and the circus would keep going. And so, as you can imagine, that work was kind of unfulfilling, to say the least. And not only that, but it was difficult to leave despite that, because you know, I got into the corporate world because I wanted to adhere to what society's conventions of success looked like. And, you know, by my late 20s, I had the six-figure salary. You know, you'd fly around the world with business class flights. You'd have all these awesome corporate junkets with TV stars emceeing and stuff like that. But deep down, come the end of the workday, when I'm standing on the train station platform at like 6 or 7 p.m. sometimes later, I was just questioning, like, what did I actually contribute today to the world? I didn't feel like I was creating any value, and I felt like I had so much more to offer. So as Steve Jobs said, you know, when you wake up too often, day after day after day, you look in the mirror and you say, I don't want to do what I'm going to do today. That period for me started to stretch out into months, where I'd feel, you know, Monday-itis, and Sunday night I'd start to get anxiety of the next morning and all that sort of stuff. And at that point, you either just start conflating work with something that I guess is just a necessary evil and it sucks and you live for the weekend, which I did for a long time, or you start to seek out alternatives and take action. And in my case, it all started with a seed of an idea for a platform called Hotdesk, which was an Airbnb for office space, if you will, which came from my own observations of a lot of vacant office space in that job. And I mean, I can talk through the story of how Hotdesk evolved, but I probably said enough on the intro, so I'm keen to pass the mic back to you guys.
Well, so I'm curious, because I'm sure the inspiration for from employee to entrepreneur came from your early days of trying to make that jump. So you had this goal ahead of you of like, I just want to do something of my own because that's direct value and I'm completely responsible for the creation and I can see the output immediately. But to get from idea to I can see the output, it for some people it takes years. So how long did it take you, and what was the first step that you took to actually making it a reality?
It definitely did not take years. The first thing I did to start testing my idea was literally just to put an ad up, a free advertisement on a website called the Australian Institute for Company Directors. I pretended that I was looking for a non-executive director. What I got instead was about 25 meetings with high caliber business executives and startup founders who'd been there, done that. And so for the price of 25 meetings times two coffees, so say $100, I was able to get a lot of free consulting, and I was being asked questions that I hadn't thought about. But the overarching response was that people who had been there, done that, people who had merit, thought that this was a good idea. So my next step was to basically get onto Upwork or freelancer.com at the time, and with a web developer I found, combined with an Airbnb script I downloaded for like $500, I was able to build the first prototype for Hotdesk for about $2,000. So at this point, I'm thinking, great, I've got a prototype, but I need someone to know about this. So as you do when you're young and naive, I Googled how to write a press release, tried my hand at it, and sent it to about 100 journalists. And this was before growth hacking tools. So I remember vividly going onto Twitter profiles and finding email addresses from the profiles and putting them into a spreadsheet and then one by one sending these emails. And of the 100 emails, how many do you think actually got back to me?
If I had to go based on our previous experience, I would say 5 to 8.
That's optimistic based on my experience with the press release. One got back to me. But it just so happened to be The Australian, which is one of the biggest newspapers in the country, 500,000 circulation. They published this one-page article a couple of weeks later. And it did mention that I was an employee of a bank called Macquarie Bank, an investment bank in Sydney. And that got picked up in the Macquarie News, a daily email of news clippings that gets sent to 14,000 people. So I got a tap on the shoulder by my manager who said, hey, what's this Hotdesk stuff all about? And I assured them that it's just a little side project. And, you know, after some toing and froing, they were cool with that. But that little side project on the back of that article, I had managed to secure $150,000 in seed funding from some investors who reached out to me. And 3 months later, side project became full-time gig. I thought I'd give it a go for about a year or so. 7 years later and countless iterations later, I have not looked back and I don't intend to.
What I love about what you did is, first of all, you weren't afraid of trying something that you didn't know or fully maybe understand, right? You just kind of took a chance and learned along the way. And that's a great takeaway, because you can't know everything when you're starting a company, and you're not going to be great at everything, but it's important that you're not afraid to basically get your hands dirty. But also, even though you had a 1% response rate, that's all you needed to get to the next stage, and then lo and behold, 7 years later, you were still working. So unless you try it, you'll never know what's going to happen.
100%. I mean, and so many people who are coming out of that corporate world where they're dealing with an existing business model that makes money, there's a lot of certainty about who our customers are, how we make money, and so on. You basically fall into the trap of planning to the nth degree, doing a lot of research and analysis and looking for perfection before you get out of the building because you've got a brand to protect, you're concerned about intellectual property and all this sort of stuff. But when you jump out of the building and you take that leap, you probably haven't got a business model that makes money yet. You're dealing with a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty. So you absolutely have to just go for it, even though you don't know if it's the right thing to do. But if you can go for it by taking small steps, so you're not placing a $100,000 bet like a lot of first-time entrepreneurs do, building an app on the back of an idea that they haven't tested with anyone, that's going to give you a high likelihood of success. But finding out what are the smallest possible steps I can take to get the learnings I need to get in order to make better decisions to figure out what that product market fit looks like, that's a big thing for a lot of first-time entrepreneurs, taking the leap to really, really double down on.
And how long did it take you to generate revenue with that idea? And then how long did it take to generate sustainable revenue?
Yeah, good question. So with marketplaces, I mean, I learned that building a marketplace, a two-sided business, is about 10 times harder than a one-sided business, because you've got to get the business model, the marketing strategy, the language, everything right for the supply side. Then you need to get it right for the demand side, and it needs to come together. It's really challenging. So with Hotdesk, I mean, building the supply side up to almost 12,000 spaces across Asia Pac, easy. It's just a distribution channel for the supply side. But for the demand side, what you find is you can make the initial introduction and maybe take like a 10 or 15% clipping. So say someone books an office space at some space in New York for a week. It's $1,000. You get $100. So we started making revenue after probably six months, maybe not even. But the problem was, once you make that initial connection, if you like the space, you tend to then negotiate directly with the space. So the recurring element isn't really there. It's not like Airbnb, right? If I book an Airbnb, I don't say, I quite like this place, I think I'm going to buy it. Yeah, nobody says that with Airbnb, at least nobody I know. But if you are looking for an office space, you try something for a week, you then negotiate directly. So that retention piece was challenging. And, you know, I worked on Hotdesk for a couple of years. We got it to almost $10,000 monthly revenue, so it wasn't bad. But one thing that I have to stress for anyone thinking about making the leap, or anybody who has made the leap and is just struggling, is it really, you need to believe in what you're doing. And while I saw an opportunity there, an opportunity to perhaps make money just doing my own thing, I didn't really believe in it. Like I wasn't that aligned with the purpose of Hotdesk. I didn't really want to be a glorified real estate agent. And and so in order to play that long game, you really need to align with the purpose. Otherwise, when the going gets tough, you're just going to give up and say, look, I don't believe in this. I'm just going to throw in the towel.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of value in being excited about an idea and just going all in and trying it like you did. I mean, there's just so much that you learn through that process. You learn sales, you learn fundraising, you learn how to do marketing, all of these things that you can't really do as an employee of a company. It's completely different than, you know, when you're doing it for yourself, because you're juggling all of those balls and ultimately you're responsible. So there's a lot of value of taking an idea, going with it, because even if it doesn't work out, there's all those learnings. But for a lot of people, even getting the idea that they're going to be excited about is actually pretty hard. And knowing whether they should go all in on that particular thing, they just feel, I think, maybe decision paralysis, and they think, am I missing another opportunity? So as you were, with the benefit of hindsight of working on this business for a few years, thinking about the next thing that you want to do and knowing that you wanted to stay independent as an entrepreneur, how did you then decide, okay, like, this is going to be the next business that I pursue, or this is going to be the next personal or creative pursuit that I'm going to now spend my time on?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, Sergey. When it comes to just going on that journey without really knowing what you're doing, I'd say that I learned so much more in that first 2 years on this entrepreneurial track than I did perhaps in the previous five in the corporate world, across sales, marketing, persuasion, product development, you name it. It was just like a trial by fire, personal MBA, as Josh Kaufman puts it. That learning trajectory hasn't tapered off either. I found that 3 to 4 years in the corporate world, like, there was quite a steep learning trajectory. But then after a while, it kind of tapered off, and the learning was replaced with playing politics rather than learning and creating value. Whereas I found that in the entrepreneurial domain, when you're constantly dealing with uncertainty and the world outside our walls is changing so quickly, you're constantly learning. Otherwise, if you're not constantly learning and adapting new strategies, you fall behind. So in terms of what I did next, it was just a stroke of serendipity. So I booked a space via my platform called Queens Collective, and I befriended the operator there. And I was a resident of this space for about a year. So we became quite good friends. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with General Assembly, the education boot camps. Yep. So they were a tenant at this particular space, but then they announced that they were going to leave. So suddenly, Sean is his name, found himself with his flagship tenant gone. He had two classrooms available. And at this point, I was reflecting on, look, I didn't really want to keep doing Hotdesk, but if I'm going to keep doing entrepreneurship, I need to do something I believe in. And so drawing on my almost decade in the corporate world as a frustrated intrapreneur, I thought, well, I've learned a lot about these different methodologies and frameworks that entrepreneurs use. Perhaps there's an opportunity to start taking this back into the corporate world, because large organizations are being disrupted. You know, the way their businesses are designed is to deliver on an existing business model, but not to discover on a new one, which is something that they need to be doing as the world changes. And so I just pitched Sean with the idea of running, say, a General Assembly kind of thing for corporates, where we would teach them the lean startup methodology and all these different things that startups use. But I wasn't going to go full steam ahead. It was about taking small bets to test whether that would work or not. And so the first thing we really did was just set up an Eventbrite page. We called it Lean Startup for Corporates or something to that effect. We put about $100 of ad spend onto it, targeted people on LinkedIn with roles like innovation manager. Got about 60 RSVPs to our first free one-hour session. And of course, even though we had all the plastic cups and food and drink and everything else, three people turned up, but that was okay. We started to build our mailing list, and then slowly but surely, through various strokes of serendipity, we eventually hooked our first big client. It took about 6 months, but that kind of gave our market the social proof we needed to keep building upon that. And now doing something that really leaves me feeling fulfilled at the end of the day, where I can see that we're creating value for people creating value for people who were once like me in the corporate world. Now they're being given more opportunity to actually take their talent and apply it and create new value. That's really fulfilling, and it's something that gets me out of bed every day.
So you mentioned strokes of serendipity, but I think you were obviously very deliberate about the work that you were doing for this type of business to attract your audience and to ultimately close your customers. So would you say that what you continue doing is putting on these in-person events, and then eventually through the relationships that you were able to build either directly or indirectly? Is that how you landed your first major client in that after 6 months?
The way we landed our first major client, it's funny. So you're right in saying that I was quite deliberate, because before we landed our first major client, I had over 300 30-minute meetings with innovation managers, human resources managers, CTOs, CIOs, you name it, anyone who would be willing to speak to me. And they weren't sales meetings, they were just learning meetings. I wanted to understand what common pain points they had, because decision-making is a big part of good decision-making is pattern recognition. And so on the back of all of those meetings, I was able to then pitch things that really went to the heart of what they were struggling with. So when this stroke of serendipity occurred, what basically happened was, as you mentioned in the intro, we've got a kids entrepreneurship program called Lemonade Stand. And we only run this during the summer holidays. Well, we were only running it during the summer holidays then. And so we ran this session, 20 kids came along, and one of the kids' moms was basically a head of innovation at a massive law firm. And she loved Lemonade Stand. She said, wow, that was so cool. She got to see the prototypes that the kids built. They pitched their ideas, all that stuff. And she said, so is this all you guys do? Do you just run Lemonade Stand all year long? And I said, no, actually, we're a corporate innovation accelerator. We work with companies to help them become more innovative. And she said, huh, that's interesting. Like, what? Perhaps you can work with us. And then that kind of opened the door to that conversation. And then probably about a month later, they had signed on the dotted line to do some work with us. And then that was that first sort of big client we got on our books that we were able to use, particularly to get other law firms to work with us. And we've worked with about 10 big law firms across the globe in the 3 years since. And I think that first client had a hell of a lot to do with it.
A couple of good questions come from that experience. First of all, speaking with 300, heads of innovation and whoever else you spoke to leading up to that, is no insignificant feat, especially if you did it, within a period of 6 months. How did you do that? Was that through the events that you ran, or did you actually book individual meetings? Like, how did you get them to respond to you?
I'd like to say we were super personal in our approach, but we weren't. We used a tool called MixMax, and we combined that with a tool called LeadIQ. So LeadIQ would basically help us scrape LinkedIn, pull out email addresses of people who fit these job titles. We then import that into MixMax, and that would send personalized emails to the 300 people. And there would also be follow-on emails, for example, if they didn't open or reply to the first email, we follow up a week later or so. And on the back of that, we managed to secure the meetings. And we'd continue to do this, like in drips and drabs, maybe once a month, batch outreach, try different customer segments, different job titles, different industries. So we probably reached out to maybe 2,000 people, if not more, during that period of time, and got the 300 meetings. So that's how we went about getting the meetings. And some people aren't comfortable with that approach, but I think when you're starting out, you just need to have as many at-bats as possible to get the learnings you need to get. Because if I'm going to personally invest the time trying to really get to know every single person, I'm going to spend 3 years trying to get to where I got to in, say, 3 months. I think that's a big thing. Sometimes people are scared to put themselves out there in that way. They've got this aversion to using automation tools, and I think it's if you can bring value to that person, you're reaching out to them because you want to make their lives better. So definitely don't hold back. It would be my view there.
I think if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to face the reality that you have to somehow, you have to move quickly. You don't have a lot of money to spend. And so you're going to have to do things that maybe later on in the life of the company, you're not going to do as much, or you would change your approach a little bit just because you have to learn as quickly as possible because you don't have the benefit of time. So it sounds like you do a lot of these hacky kind of experiments to build a lot of traction really quickly. Is that something that you talk about in your upcoming book?
Yeah, so the book does deep dive into something called, one of the chapters is called 10X Your Productivity, which does delve into how do you go about effectively prioritizing? Because productivity essentially is what you don't do. And as Peter Drucker said, there's nothing worse than the wrong things done right. which is something that I find shows up in the corporate world where people are always trying to get more efficient at doing the thing that doesn't really add that much value. So effective prioritization, that chapter also then delves into automation. I mean, if it's something that's rudimentary, a step-by-step task, something you can turn into an algorithm, or perhaps there's already off-the-shelf tools like Zapier that you could use to automate something, you should be automating it, because time is the most precious commodity you have as an entrepreneur, and you shouldn't be doing something that a computer can do for you for like $10 a month. And then if you can't automate it, outsource it. You know, I think it was Perry Marshall in his book 80-20 Sales and Marketing who talks about $10 an hour tasks, and how as an entrepreneur, you should not be wasting your time on $10 an hour tasks, be that admin or something to that effect. You should outsource that. And then that just frees you up to focus on the high value tasks. And that requires ongoing self-awareness, because you might find those high value tasks, but that doesn't mean that you do them ad infinitum for the next 3 years. Like, you need to reflect on that maybe every month or so and draw up a quadrant like I do and determine how you spend your time, and then determine what should I do more of, less of, what should I start doing, what should I stop doing, and constantly be updating that, because otherwise it's very easy to fall into the trap of doing for the sake of doing and feeling busy, which human beings derive a sense of importance from, but not really moving the needle. So that self-awareness piece as an entrepreneur in terms of how you spend your time is absolutely key.
You actually had a really great article on Medium that I read called How to Be Half as Busy and Twice as Productive and Effective, where you mentioned the Perry Marshall concept. Is a really cool table. You guys should check it out. Now just look up Steve Glaveski on Medium and you'll find that article. But can you talk about how and when you made that transition for yourself? Maybe it's when, as you were running Collective Campus, but what were the steps that you took to outsource those $10 tasks? How did you find people to outsource it to? How did you gauge whether or not they were going to be effective at those roles and you can rely on them to do those tasks, which, you know, they might be $10 an hour tasks, but they still need to be done right in order to keep the ship moving along.
So in terms of even becoming aware enough to know that I should be outsourcing and automating, I mean, that's just reading a lot of different things, right? So I think as an entrepreneur, you constantly need to be consuming the right amount of content. Like, you don't want to consume to the nth degree where you stop actually building and executing, right? It's the whole inverted U. Learning up until a certain point is great if it empowers you to make better decisions. But if all you do is learn, then you're not actually investing in your business. So something I talk about in the book is collecting dots, whether that's blogs, reading blogs, listening to podcasts, audiobooks, all that stuff, because then you can make better decisions. Like I said, pattern recognition. Once I determined that outsourcing and automation was something we needed to look at, particularly on the outsourcing piece, if you're going to outsource, say, to someone in, say, Southeast Asia, for example, don't just assume that they're going to get it. Like, you need to be really explicit and specific with your instructions. So I've got Google Docs. Some of them are about 10 to 15 pages long, step-by-step instructions, screenshots, all that sort of stuff. And even then, I know that if someone is new and they've just started to work with us, that there is still going to be a teething period. And so you need to be a little bit flexible when you onboard someone like that, but provide really explicit instructions. And then if they haven't picked it up after, say, a couple of weeks, that's a red flag for me. Usually after two or three attempts at something, they should be pretty much on point and ready to take it on. So we take that approach with people, and it's a case of hire fast, fire slow when it comes to the outsourcing piece as well. And one of our most valued team members is a virtual assistant we've got in the Philippines who's been with us for about 2.5 years. And she is indispensable, in my opinion. And so you also need to be treating people like that, once they demonstrate value, like a member of your team and not just some person, you know, out in the ether who happens to do a whole bunch of work for you.
That's definitely very key, and we can attest to that from our experience outsourcing too. You can burn a lot of money with people if you don't give them very, very specific instructions. When we talk about people starting to work on business ideas and executing on business ideas while they're still working, you know, a lot of people say, I only have so much time in the day, you know, I work till 6 or 7, come home, have dinner, you know, people have kids, that's even more limitations, right? And maybe I have a 2-3 hour window a day. Now, if you talk to Gary Vee, he'll tell you, find time, work till 3 in the morning. But if you got to get up at 6-7 the next morning, I wouldn't recommend that for folks. So given that for most people, that 2-3 hours a day that they're going to spend on that idea, that venture is so critical, do you have any tips or advice on how to get the most out of that time? Certainly, outsourcing things that you shouldn't be doing is one of those ways. But even focus, like sitting down and focusing for those 2-3 hours so that output is meaningful. Any advice on how you were able to do that or how you advise others to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question, man. I mean, when I was starting out and side hustling with Hotdesk, I definitely wasn't super deliberate about it. But I guess looking back, in hindsight, what I really did do was focus on building something to help me test those assumptions. So it depends where you are in that journey. Like if you're just starting out, it's really about identifying what are the key assumptions that underpin whether or not your business venture will be successful or not. And those key assumptions are really a reflection of how impactful something will be to your business, and then how certain or uncertain you are if that is actually true. So in the case of, say, let's just pick Uber, like when they're starting out, one of their big key assumptions is trust. Trust that people will jump into a car with a stranger. Now, the impact of that is, say, 10 out of 10, if that's not true. But then the certainty piece, back then for the founders of Uber, maybe they would have said, well, we're about 5 out of 10 certainty, so let's find a way to quickly, cheaply test this. And so that wouldn't have been building the full platform and onboarding drivers and everything else. It would have been, hey, let's go out to busy taxi ranks and test this with actual people who are waiting to get a ride and see if they're willing to pay $20 to get into a car. That's a cheap, low fidelity way to test this. So that's what you should be focused on initially, because so many entrepreneurs jump to conclusions. And when they do that, they think that the reason their business isn't taking off is because it's a marketing problem. But more often than not, it's a value proposition problem. And they haven't done the work up front to really test those assumptions, figure out who the customer segment is, what's the real problem they're solving, and how much are people willing to pay for this solution. So if you're just starting out, that's what you should focus on. Of course, as you get further along that journey, starting to automate and outsource things so you can just focus on business development, strategy, the important stuff that's going to move the needle is key. But one alternative to having the side hustle, if you've spent years in the corporate world, chances are you qualify for, say, contractor roles at large organizations. And one carrot I used while I was starting Collective Campus, the first 6 months, I didn't pay myself anything. But what I did do, I secured a 2-day-a-week gig with KPMG. And this gig paid about, you know, $800 a day or something to that effect, which contractor roles tend to pay quite well. So 2 days a week, that was plenty for me to just, you know, satisfy whatever financial commitments I had. But then rather than just having 3 hours at the end of the day where I'm already, you know, mentally drained, I could focus, say, 3 weekdays completely on the business, which is way more, meaningful than 3 hours at the end of the day when I've already used up most of my cognitive capacity.
That's good advice as well for people that might not want or be able to get the work done during the week because they have kids and everything like that. If you do have a full-time job, you probably have the weekend. And if the weekend's mm-hmm. going to be your highest output time, then that's what the commitment that you need to make in order to achieve that next step and get to your goal. But something else that I wanted to ask you is, obviously, one of the other things that you started doing is writing, both blog posts, obviously more content like your podcast, but more specifically, you became a best-selling author on Amazon, and now you have your new book coming out, which I believe if you go to employeetoentrepreneur.io, you can get more information there too. But talk about that process, because writing is such a high focus and high demand thing that you have to, activity that you have to do. But beyond that, once you allocate all of that time up front, you also have to market it.
Yeah, right? There's no guarantee that it's going to sell.
There's no guarantee, but you know, you have to make sure if you're putting in the effort and you think that you're creating highly valuable content, which obviously you do, you want an audience that can actually consume it and benefit from it. So talk about, I guess, maybe your first experience. Obviously, it was pretty successful. You were an Amazon bestseller, but all the way through now, how did you master this skill of not only writing good content, but knowing how to market it effectively?
Yeah, great question. I think for anyone who's looking at going down that content creation route, just you need to divorce yourself from engagement rates to start with, because I have written at least 100 or maybe even 200 blog posts that I've poured an hour to 3 hours into each, and sometimes they get no engagement. But what that does help me do is oftentimes when I'm writing these blog posts, I am consolidating a lot of the knowledge. You know, they say if you want to really learn something, write it down, teach other people. And so if I've read a book, spoken to people, I've got these different connections that I've started to make, I will turn that into a blog post, because if nothing else, that helps me learn. But then on the marketing side of things, there's, again, there's automation tools you can use to help you with that, whether it's Buffer to publish across multiple platforms, whether that's repurpose.io, so you can turn a blog post into an audiogram, you can turn it into, say, a video, get it published across different platforms. These are different tools that can help you just expand your reach, along with QPromote. QPromote is a tool from SumoMe, which again will publish your content in relevant places. So you might tag it as, this is about startups. And then that will go out to influencers in that space who are more likely to share it, and you will see an uptick in your traction there. But one thing that I guess we've tried to do is when we create content, we will directly try and share that with people who, aside from automation tools, who we think will be interested. So I might write a blog post and mention a number of influencers in that blog post, and then I'll contact them and say, hey, I wrote this post, it mentions, say, Perry Marshall's framework on $10 an hour tasks and so on. If you're a fan of it, share it. You know, we'd really appreciate that. Now, that doesn't always work. Maybe one out of every four, it does. But that one out of every four, if they've got an audience of 100,000, it starts to pick up. But man, it's you've got to be willing to play the long game. Just like in entrepreneurship, like you're going to hear a quote unquote no, or you're going to get a lot of no engagement until you break through. And even now, I mean, I've got the Harvard Business Review article, which has done really well, but I'm still publishing stuff on my Medium blog, which sometimes still gets no likes or claps or whatever it is these days. And that's completely fine because I'm still doing it for my own knowledge consolidation. But content, the reason we got into content is because we're selling to big organizations. And so we started turning those blog posts into a vehicle for us to position ourselves as thought leaders. And so if we had a conversation with someone at a large company and they said, yeah, we don't know how to measure innovation. How do you do that? Oh, by the way, we've got this article called How to Measure Innovation. And then that starts to give them confidence in your abilities. And when you have that confidence, you're far more likely to do business with someone. And then the last thing I want to say on the content piece is really around ebooks, because we started to take these blog posts and put them into ebooks. Say, for example, really industry-specific ebooks like Innovation in Insurance. And then we would shoot these over to people on LinkedIn, taking a similar automation approach that we did before. And we would say, hi, Joe, see that you work for FWD Insurance. We just published this ebook called Innovation Insurance. It might be of interest. We're not selling anything. We're giving them free value. But if they download that ebook, they're then in our mailing list. They start to receive our content. They start to receive our podcast updates. And that's how we can build that relationship with them or that confidence in our brand, so that when they are ready to buy, because timing, budget, appetite needs to align, when they are ready, they're far more likely to do business with us than someone else.
And that makes a lot of sense. But I have to ask, since you're selling to larger organizations and, you know, you create a lot of content around entrepreneurship and innovation, how do you reconcile that? I mean, when they look at you as an individual, as a brand, and you're trying to sell them basically a way for their employees to be more innovative, does the question ever come up of like, well, are you basically going to teach my employees how to empower themselves to get out of here and start something of their own? Does that come up?
Oh, look, it does come up. And what I tell them is, your employees, if they are that way inclined, they're going to leave anyway. But you want to harness that energy while they are in the building rather than just lose them. And you know what? If you do give them the environments, the tools, the resources they need to do that stuff internally, maybe that's enough. Because, you know, I had on several occasions presented better ways of doing things at some of my past employers. And oftentimes it was a case of, yeah, cool, but not right now. Didn't align with the incentives of the organization and all that sort of stuff. So if I was given that opportunity, who knows, maybe I would have stayed there because you had a lot of boxes ticked. So whether it was the salary and everything else that I mentioned earlier, you know, if I was just given the opportunity to create more value internally and to leave work feeling a little bit more fulfilled, then perhaps I'd stay. But if I'm going to leave, then I may as well create value for that organization before I do. And in some cases, certain organizations are basically seeding their most innovative employees and saying, look, if you want to go off and start a business related to our industry, we want to give you $50,000 for 5% of your business. And that way you can take a piece of that employee with you before they leave the building.
And that's certainly happening more and more now. I think we're going to see more of that in the next 5 to 10 years, where companies are going to have an appetite for that because people want to be entrepreneurial, and why not have a piece of that?
Steve Glaveski, I think we just scratched the surface with the amount of knowledge and information that you have that so many people can resonate with. And so to find out more about you, I know they can follow you on Steve Glaveski on Twitter, collectivecampus.us, your new book that's coming out, Employee to Entrepreneur, that's employeetoentrepreneur.us. Entrepreneur.io. Of course, your podcast, Future Squared, and your new podcast, Employer to Entrepreneur. I know you also do stand-up and you ride motorcycles. I feel like there's nothing you don't do.
Yeah, I mean, just on that stand-up thing, I think something, you know, entrepreneurs need to develop a really good relationship with adversity. And the reason I got into stand-up was it was just another thing I could do to really get out of my comfort zone. Because I'm comfortable getting up in front of, say, 300 people at a business conference and talking about, say, entrepreneurship. But put me in a smoky back bar somewhere in front of 15 people, all with a beer in their hand, waiting for you to make them laugh for just 5 minutes. And for some reason, that's just one of the most confronting things in the world. But the more you can put yourself in uncomfortable situations, the better suited you'll be to entrepreneurship.
That's a great parting piece of advice. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable, because ultimately that's what entrepreneurship is about. But also life. You know, life throws things that are unpredictable to you and at you all the time. And if you're able to have the tools and ability to essentially roll with the punches of life, just like in entrepreneurship, you're going to be able to get past even the most difficult times. And there always is going to be difficult times. But obviously, the upside of creating your own life and creating a schedule where you can do whatever you want and pursue all of your various different interests. You only live once, and that's what most people should strive for anyways. Steve Gillespie, thank you so much for being on the show. Your book comes out today on January 9th. Please go to employeetoentrepreneur.io to find out more. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, guys. It's been a pleasure.